News Radio 92.3,
informative, local, dependable. Welcome back to Pep Talk. I'm your host, PJ, today filling in once again for Meg. Todd Thompson from the Pensacola Chamber is in studio with me.
Yeah, so thanks, PJ, for that. So we have a special edition of the Chamber Connection show today. We had our legislative wrap-up lunch last week, and we heard from Gray Robinson. They had three lobbyists come and tell us everything that happened during the legislative session. And this is just an opportunity to get kind of the overview of what they talked about, some of the questions that were asked about some of the key issues that passed during session, primarily the property tax reform issue that is on everyone's minds right now. So they give a lot of great information, talk about the bills that passed, the bills that didn't pass, you know, some of the appropriations that impacted our community. The budget is yet to be signed by the governor, but that's something we're keeping an eye on. But again, this is a great opportunity. Hope you enjoy listening to this. Again, we had three lobbyists from Gray Robinson, Chris Dawson, Carlisha Collins, and George Levesque that are on the ground in Tallahassee during session following what happens. Chris Dawson actually is the lobbyist for Escambia County, so he is really on top of what's happening here locally, keeping an eye on those key appropriations for our community. So it was a very interesting event, great opportunity to hear about what's happening and get the latest updates from Tallahassee. So, again, this is our legislative wrap-up lunch that was held last week, and we're going to hear from our friends from Gray Robinson coming up right now.
Well, I hope you enjoyed your lunch. I can tell y'all are having some great conversations, but now we're ready for our presentation. We are very fortunate to have some good friends with us today. They've done this for a number of years now, and they always do a tremendous job. With the Gray Robinson firm, I'd like to call up now George Levesque, Carlisha Collins, and Chris Dawson.
All right. Thank you, Todd. Before we get going, just again, a round of applause and recognition to Todd and his team for putting on this event every year. It really is an excellent opportunity to come and visit with everyone and share what has happened in Tallahassee. First, I'll introduce our team a little more. We're thrilled to be with you today. Chris Dawson with the firm. I'm based out of our Orlando and Tampa offices, but I'm a native of Northwest Florida. So always great to come home and see a friendly hometown crowd. Also want to share that we have George Levesque, our managing shareholder in our Tallahassee office, and Carlisha Collins, also from our Tallahassee office, representing decades of experience in the Florida legislative process. I just finished my 12th year working with the Florida legislature, so I'm the baby on the team when it comes to that. But we've seen a lot. I don't know that we've seen a year quite like this year with all of the activity that's gone on in Tallahassee. But we want to jump in and share a little bit with you about what went down over in the state capitol. We always love to kick off this presentation by talking a little bit about the players. You have to understand who's in a leadership role, who is helping to set the agenda in Tallahassee before we can understand why a session goes any different way it goes, why we get pushed into special session, and what issues are brought to bear. So this is our current executive office, statewide leadership. Of course, some very familiar faces, Governor Ron DeSantis finishing up his last year as governor. Of course, we know that's going to be a very competitive race going into November. His lieutenant governor, Jay Collins, one of the folks running to be the next governor of Florida. Jay was appointed to this role by the current governor. James Uthmeyer is our current attorney general. He, too, is sitting in an appointed seat currently. He is running for his first full term as attorney general this fall. Blaise Ngolia, current chief financial officer, currently sitting in an appointed seat. He'll also run for his first term as CFO this fall. And then lastly, our statewide elected commissioner of agriculture, Welton Simpson, he is currently elected, so he will be running for his second term to this role. But they largely set from the executive branch the policy and agenda that we see that's then put to the legislature for consideration. Over in the Florida House of Representatives, we have the same leadership that we had last year. So our current speaker is Danny Perez. He is from the Miami-Dade County area. Lawrence McClure is his appropriations chairman, so he leads budget negotiations for the House. He is out of Hillsborough County. Tyler Seroy is the current majority leader for the Republican caucus. Of course, we do have a supermajority of Republicans in the Florida House. He's from the Space Coast. And then Wyman Duggan is our House Speaker pro tem from the Jacksonville area. Bottom of the slide here, Sam Garrison, he is the current rules chairman. Maybe more importantly at this point, he's the incoming speaker of the Florida House. So we do know future leadership and who is going to sit in those roles because we have term limits in the state. And then lastly, Frances Driscoll is the minority leader. So she represents the Democratic caucus, works with the majority party where there can be areas to go across party lines. Over in the Florida Senate, Ben Albritton, current Senate president from Polk County. Ed Hooper, Appropriations Chairman from Pinellas County. Jim Boyd, current Majority Leader, he is from Manatee County. He is also the incoming Senate President, so a future presiding officer in Jim Boyd. Jason Broder, Senate Pro Tem, is from Seminole County near the Orlando area. Kathleen Pasadomo, current Rules Chair, former Senate President, is from the Naples area. And then lastly, Lori Berman is the Senate Minority Leader. There is also a Republican supermajority in the Florida Senate. So she leads the minority caucus in working with leadership, and she is from the Palm Beach County area. So those are the players, but their priorities also carry a substantial amount of weight, and that is a large part of the lens that any particular session will go through. What are the governor's priorities? What are the presiding officer's priorities? And how do those pieces fit together? And George is going to walk us through a little bit of how that set the stage for a rather tumultuous session this year.
Thank you, Chris. With any session, you're always looking at what the governor's priorities are, what the speaker's priorities are, what the Senate president's priorities are. And there are a lot of things that can throw those kind of priorities off track. Sometimes it's because those presiding officers don't agree on what they want to do, or they don't agree with the other side's priorities. Other times it's they don't agree on the timing. You had a little bit of both of that going on here. First one was property tax reform. The House, when they were putting together their schedule of events and their work schedule, they wanted to go ahead and get property tax off the table. The way the governor was talking about the issue with completely repealing property taxes, including those that would be used to fund schools, that would obviously create some budget heartache for them. They wanted to figure out how to solve that problem. That was one of their motivations for trying to push something this legislative session. Ultimately, they ended up passing something over to the Senate. The Senate was much more sympathetic to where the governor was on the issue. The governor wanted to wait until after the legislation session, deal with the budget, deal with those things in the regular session, and we'll come back and fix it, because on the horizon, even before the regular legislative session had started, the governor had signaled that he wanted a special session on congressional redistricting. One of the things that did pass, data centers. The legislature was able to pass protections for the average consumer so that data centers are not, as they come up and come online, the utility companies are not able to give them favorable deals. The legislature implemented changes that are intended to protect the average consumer.
Just to draw a couple more local comparisons on some of the budget priorities, we've talked a lot about how revenues at the state level have been reduced year over year. I think this is our fourth straight year with the legislature and the governor delivering a budget that is tighter than the year before. But that doesn't mean that the legislature and the governor have been skimping on priorities that are important to Northwest Florida. And so a couple of things that I would point out in that budget chart, if you recall, that Carlicia had up, she mentioned health and human services, which, of course, is a growing piece of the budget. Another area where the legislature and the governor have heavily invested is in transportation and economic development. That includes things like our programs that help support our military installations. That includes the FDOT work program that the legislature has fully funded year in and year out, really over the last several years. And, you know, so that while they are tightening the belt in Tallahassee, they are still focusing on those things that are important to our region. That does include local projects, and this is just a sampling of some of the funding that was brought back to Northwest Florida by our fantastic delegation. I always like to pause the presentation at this point. I know we've recognized them once, but I want to recognize them again. We've got Representative Michelle Salzman at the front, Representative Alex Andrade in the back. They are up there tirelessly throughout legislative session and in the last couple of years, special session after special session, fighting for these appropriations dollars to come back to Northwest Florida. So with the budget getting smaller, but priorities and needs growing, it really is a testament to our excellent delegation that we have this type of appropriation support coming back from our state. So I want to give them a round of applause again on that. So talking about revenues, there's one other big conversation going on around the state related to revenues. George touched on it a little bit at the beginning. He's going to talk to you now about what actually did pass during that property tax special session. George is going to walk us through what's in the referendum and the implementing bill, and then we'll talk a little bit about the politics around that and some of the potential outcomes.
Chris wasn't exaggerating when he said that everybody in the state is talking about it. I can tell you I've been outside of the state, and I've had people bring it up with me. I had a blackjack dealer in Chicago, my brother-in-law in Indiana, some people that I met out in California, they'd heard about what the governor was proposing, and they were fascinated by it, and even the blackjack dealer said that he'd relocate if it passed. What did pass? What did pass was not exactly what the governor wanted. The governor was looking for something that would completely wipe out property taxes for a homeowner for their primary residence. What ended up happening was a juiced up version of that in terms of a super homestead exemption. There would be an additional $150,000 exemption from the assessed value. And I don't want to get down too into the weeds of how property tax administration works because it's very complicated. I don't know why it needs to be so complicated, but that's the way they do it. But in the first year, kicking in 2027, there'd be a $150,000 exemption. In the second year, January 1, 2028, that bumps up to an additional $250,000 exemption. For most of the homes in Florida, that would essentially wipe out your regular property taxes. What the legislature ultimately did was they did that for all ad valorem property taxes except schools. And I want to be clear, they only addressed the ad valorem property taxes that counties and municipalities levy under their authority and under their umbrella. They didn't deal with anything. They didn't deal with sales taxes. They didn't deal with special assessments. They didn't deal with things that are not tied to the ad valorem calculation. We're still looking at what the impacts of that will be county by county. Just like the congressional litigation the congressional redistricting where something was filed and passed, legislation came. There has been a challenge that is brought. The legislation that's described here is essentially two bills. You've got a joint resolution that will be placed before the voters, so the voters will get to make the decision on whether the super exemptions go into effect. There are other provisions related to the administration of property taxes that deal with what a local government would be required to do to go over what is called the rollback rate. The rollback rate, in very kind of blunt terms, is essentially the revenues that have been generated by the tax base that would have been the year before rolled forward plus 10%. That would be considered the rollback rate. There are certain things that come out of that. So, for example, new development, additions, increases in assessments based upon modifications to the property, those don't count in terms of calculating the rollback rate. But generally what you're looking at is what our tax base was last year plus 10%. That's going to be your rollback rate. If the local government wants to go above that rollback rate, they will need to have a supermajority vote to make that pass. Before I turn that over on the litigation, there has been a constitutional challenge that's been brought to the joint resolution. One of the historical ways that folks who don't like what someone who's proposing an amendment to the Constitution will do is they'll bring a challenge saying that the ballot language is misleading. That's precisely the type of challenge that's brought here. It would only affect the joint resolution. I've heard rumors that there might be a challenge to the actual legislation, the administrative legislation that's passed. I haven't seen that lawsuit filed yet, but it is one of those things where I would expect in probably the next month or two we'd probably get a decision from the courts on whether this property tax proposal will be on the ballot. At this point, I wouldn't begin to estimate what the likelihood of success on that would be.
Now, for those of you who have seen us present before, this is what we lovingly refer to as the lightning round, because believe it or not, the legislature did do other things this year besides property tax reform and congressional redistricting. So we want to talk to you a little bit about what happened during the regular session, some of the bills that passed. These are going to cut across different industries and different focuses, but you'll see a good representation of the types of issues that the legislature takes takes up on any given year. Local administration of vessel restrictions. This was a bill that was actually written by the staff at Escambia County. It allows for county code enforcement to supplement law enforcement on siting and removing derelict vessels. So for those of us who are around for Hurricane Sally, you remember all the boats scattered around. It takes forever to get those out because there's a complicated process that's been set up in Tallahassee that largely requires law enforcement officers to be participating in every step of that process. This now only requires the law enforcement officer to participate in criminal portions of the derelict vessel law. And then bills that died. Now I get to play Grim Reaper because, as we've talked about, because of some of the internal frictions that went along in Tallahassee this year, there wasn't a substantial amount of policy that you would see on a typical year that got across the finish line. So these are the bills that did not pass this year. The bill we're all here for and sad to see die, the state bird changed to flamingo. It did come up one leg short this year, so we expect that one might be back. Commissioner Hofberger, I'm sorry, I did use that joke yesterday, so forgive me. Don't tell the rest of the commission. So that's the update that we have for you all. We're very excited to hear your questions. We're going to do our best to answer them, particularly on property tax, as you've heard. I think a lot of folks are still peeling back the onion and figuring out exactly what was in the joint resolution, what's in the implementing bill, and what those outcomes may look like. So we'll do our best to answer your questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to be with you all.
And, yeah, we'll start with one on property tax. So it is still very fresh. But there have been a lot of articles, a lot of conversations about the, kind of the political lines that are being drawn. Do we really know at this point who's for it, who's against it, what kind of campaign we might see?
Two observations from me, and then I'll hand it to the team. I was interested during special session to see that the measures did receive bipartisan support in the Senate. That was interesting to me. I think a lot of us in the process expected that the Democrats would vote in bloc. But what we heard from some of the Democratic members was frustration from their constituents that housing is not affordable, that they feel like their lives aren't affordable. And I think it was Senator Roussan out of Pinellas County who said, my options are give my voters no choice or give them a choice, and I'm going to elect to give them a choice. So that was just an interesting cross line that I saw. There were two Republicans that voted against the measure in the House. They happened to be from Northwest Florida, and they voted more so on home rule and home decisions. So it didn't necessarily cut, as you might expect, perfectly along party lines. We do still expect that the campaigns largely may fall along party lines. You asked about what groups, you know, certainly local governments, they're via their trade associations mostly on the lobbying side. I think Florida Association of Counties, Florida League of Cities, Florida Association of Clerks of Court, Florida Association of Property Appraisers, those are the groups that I think will be involved in some of the messaging and electioneering against the measure. I'm going to be interested to see where some of the business groups come out on it. The Florida Chamber, AIF, haven't taken formal positions yet. You know, a lot of their members hold commercial property. Commercial property is not a beneficiary of all the protections. It does get the year-over-year cap decrease from 10% down to 5%. So I think that's going to cut different ways among their members. So it'll be very interesting to see. I think the governor is fully committed. I think you're going to see him out, you know, utilizing his large megaphone around the state. For the Republicans in the room, Byron Donalds, presumptive nominee there, has endorsed the idea of property tax reform. So I think you're going to hear about it on the campaign trail too. But
I would agree with what Chris said. Just in terms of the way, in my experience talking to people about, okay, this is what they're looking at doing. What do you think? And then you start kind of in. Universally, everybody, you mean I won't have to pay property taxes? I'll actually own my home when it's paid off? Sign me up. That is everybody's response. And then when you start talking about, okay, well, you're creating this hole in a local government budget. What do you do then? How do you fix that? When they start thinking through the logistics of how that's going to work and what that means, particularly when I'm talking to small business owners, landlords that own rental properties, the local government needs to get that revenue from somewhere. And right now, under the current system, without the amendment, it skews heavily in favor of the residential homeowner. It skews against anybody who's not homesteaded. So they're really the ones that are kind of paying some of that burden because it's their assessments that go up more than everybody else's. So what you're going to see is you're still going to see that, you know, 5% assessment go up if it passes and gets reduced, but that still doesn't compare with the 3% that the Save Our Homes people get. And not only that, anytime those commercial properties sell, the value will readjust. With a homeowner, you've got portability that you can take that and go someplace else with it. So you're not even feeling it with the homeowners when your retirees are selling their big home and downsizing because the kids are no longer home, or the empty nesters, I probably should call them. Those folks, that changes the dynamic. And when the conversation that I have, people start their opinions start to shift. So to Chris's point, it'll be interesting to see where the business community comes out on it, and where your, you know, maybe slightly well-off person that's got, you know, some investment properties, how they're going to kind of perceive what's going on. Because at the end of the day, they're still going to want roads, they're still going to want schools, they're still going to want the services that the county provides or the city provides, and they need to be paid for somehow. The other, I think, unknown is all of the changes only affect the property taxes. They haven't done anything with special assessments, so it'll be interesting to see how the different local governments grapple with how do we fill our budget holes if this passes.
Kind of following up on that, and Chris, you touched on home rule, which has been a big conversation as well, and the impact. Are local governments going to have to go to Tallahassee and beg for money if this passes, if there are shortfalls? What happens there?
Yeah, there have been some interesting questions about the role that this could shift between, you know, truly home rule local budgeting decisions, and then if you have budget shortfalls at the local level, you know, where do those revenues get made up? And Tallahassee is going to play a significant role in that in a number of different ways. You know, as George alluded to, this measure doesn't touch on local option sales tax. It doesn't touch on TDT and other forms of revenue, fee-for-service models. And so, you know, what leeway is the legislature going to be willing to give local governments to make up revenue in other areas is a question that, if this passes, you know, that's a lot of what we'll be talking about next year in Tallahassee. Early on, you may have heard some information about doing a trust fund at the state level to backfill certain local governments if they have budget shortfalls. A lot of the early conversation around that was focused on rural counties and fiscally constrained counties. The governor in his proposed budget did put forward a $300 million line item, presumably for that purpose of local budget, you know, shortfalls. But again, you know, you would have to go to Tallahassee to get those funds. When we got into special session, the legislature did not elect to fund that during the budget special session. And then during the special session on property tax reform, they did not follow the governor's lead in creating that trust fund at all. And then there was some commentary from the Senate in particular about it's a little misleading to create a trust fund that has no money. So they pulled that out of the bill, leaving in large question, I think, the appetite that Tallahassee is going to have to directly appropriate state dollars to backfill some of those lost revenues. So it is going to be an interesting dynamic that is part of the conversation, I think. And, you know, I know the counties are meeting next week in Tallahassee. The League of Cities will have their meetings, and they're really kind of getting their arms around what messaging they want to use, you know, to signal to their constituents what type of changes they would see in services, you know, in their relationship between their local commissioners versus state officials. And so it's a great question. Unfortunately, I think there's more questions than answers on that topic as we sit here today. This is a conversation that is not going away. If this proposal doesn't pass, I think we will be back next year talking about this issue again. It could be another constitutional amendment. It could be, you know, is there a kumbaya among the parties where there is a more proactive conversation between local governments in Tallahassee about freeing up different types of revenue for certain purposes? If it results in property tax abatement that's broad-based, that could be part of the conversation. But the short answer to your question, Todd, is yes. I think this is an issue that's going to be around regardless of whether HJR 1 passes or not. Florida is on very sound financial footing, and we do seem to navigate our way through some of those budget considerations.
Well, great. With that, we've gone past 1 o'clock, and just want to say thank you again to our panelists, Chris, Carlicia, and George. Incredible information. Thank you so much. They'll be around if y'all have some individual questions for them. But thank you again. Oh, we've got one more wrap up.
Yeah, just on the way out the door, we do have a little memo that outlines the property tax referendum. If you want to grab that to take with you, we'll have them up here at the front. But again, Todd, thanks to you and your team for an incredible event. These are always so much fun to do, so thanks for having us.
Thank you again to Navy Federal Credit Union, our silver sponsor, and to our hosts here at Marcus Point Baptist Church. You all have a great day.